let's get started, everyone. So yesterday we started talking about Kerr black holes. We introduced the Kerr metric and Bohr-Lincus coordinates. So I just wrote again the same thing that from last class. And we talked about how this metric basically has problems at two different radii. One radii is r equals zero, and we argued that was a curvature singularity. And then the other place where the metric goes bad is when this this delta quantity equals zero. And we said that happens at these two different radii. R plus and R minus. And then we argued that this R plus actually corresponds to the event horizon of the black hole, but that nothing singular is happening there. So as an example of the fact that that's just kind of a coordinate singularity, we're not going to talk about this much beyond this, but I just want to mention, you know, there are perfectly good coordinates for Kerr that are so-called horizon penetrating. They don't have any problem with the horizon. They continue smoothly through the horizon. So one particular nice one is so-called Kerr-Shield Cartesian coordinates. So this is Kerr written another way. You can see that, you know, for zero mass, it just reduces to usual Minkowski. And you know, actually it has this so-called Kerr-Shield form where you can think of this as a null vector here, or sorry, the product of two null vectors. But so in order to go from...
A question, sorry. None of these two coordinates are in aerial coordinates, right? I couldn't find it anywhere. I was just like searching through it yesterday. I don't think none of them are in aerial coordinates. Like, it's not very important, but you know, I just was wondering if they are.
Right, so you're saying you want some coordinates such that a surface of constant radius corresponds to the aerial radius of that surface?
Yeah. Like, you know, the surface of that radius of that sphere could be like 4 pi r squared. Like, the r would be the final lattice.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's definitely not true here. I think that's true here if it's non-spinning, but
yeah.
Not if it's spinning, I guess, right?
It was like a general question. It's okay. Sorry. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So to go from these Bohr-Lincus coordinates to Kerr-Shield coordinates. So first of all, this this R now is just like a kind of implicit function of x, y, and z. It's given by this equation. So this is the R in Bohr-Lincus coordinates, but this T is not the same as Bohr-Lincus coordinates. So it's given by a coordinate transformation like this. And you can see that, you know, this coordinate transformation is going to be singular when delta goes to zero, which kind of makes sense if we're going... So really, we should think of this as the better coordinates, and then you can go to these coordinates doing the inverse transformation. But it doesn't work at delta, which is why these coordinates are not good at when delta equals zero. And then you also are doing a coordinate transformation on the azimuthal angle. And then with this sort of new azimuthal angle, you have this transformation to go from sort of spherical polar-like coordinates to Cartesian. So you notice that there's this extra sort of a complex phase coming from the spin component. And so again, as we mentioned yesterday, this, you know, R equals zero theta equals pi over 2. That's where we have the singularity. And these coordinates, that's just going to correspond to x squared plus y squared equals a squared. Okay, but yeah, that's kind of all we're going to say about these coordinates for now. And we're going to sort of stick for the rest of the lecture to using these coordinates just because they're easier to compute things in. Right, so maybe finally we can draw the sort of conformal diagram of Kerr. So the way these conformal diagrams work, 45 lines at 45 degrees correspond to null lines, and then anything sort of horizontal line or in between the null lines would be space-like, and then the lines in between here would be time-like. On our conformal diagram, so this part we call scribe minus. So these would be lines coming here correspond to incoming null rays. This is space-like infinity, and this is future null infinity. So you know, any light you send outwards from our black hole would end up here. Any gravitational waves, that's scribe plus. And then our horizon of the black hole, sort of the boundary between the black hole interior and here and future null infinity would be R plus. So as we mentioned last class, this is a null line. And then inside, this is the black hole interior. And then inside, at some point, R becomes time-like. So that's why you have to keep falling into the black hole until you reach R minus. At which point it's null again, and then this singularity you mentioned would be here. And of course, you can just like with Schwarzschild, you can have like another copy of the black hole here, and you can repeat this sort of in the maximally extended Kerr solution. But that's kind of a mathematical construction in the sense that. We don't think that has much to do with, black holes that actually be formed in the universe. In particular, if you're forming an object from collapse, then you would sort of cover up all that, other universe stuff and so on. It'd be sort of regular until you have some matter that falls through and starts collapsing. And then also, while the Kerr solution seems remarkably robust and stable, outside the event horizon, the same is not true inside the horizon. So it's a sort of subject of ongoing research to determine what the true nature of a singularity would be inside a spinning black hole, formed from realistic collapse. We're pretty sure that this picture sort of breaks down somewhere between R plus and R minus. In particular, we can see that R minus is what's called a Cauchy horizon, in the sense that if I specify some data here, and then evolve it forward, once I get past R minus, you have points that basically depend, or said another way, the observer can see having their past light cone points that are not on the surface. So, you know, here everything is determined by these conditions, but once you cross R minus, that's not true. You can also see that, you know, if you have a observer falling through the black hole as they cross R minus, basically all the light that's going to fall into the black hole in its entire history will intersect that observer in sort of finite time. So that's another reason to not believe in this R minus. Yeah, so sort of for the rest of
the... I understand the difference between the two reasons that you gave. I think, are they the same? Because basically you're saying the past like on everything. So if you start with an initial condition and you move forward, after you go past R minus, those initial conditions cannot explain after R minus because you can...
Yeah, exactly.
But also, you said if you have, I don't know, what is that called? Time infinity time? That line?
Null
infinity. Yeah, null infinity. But you said if you
pass null infinity, this is
pass null infinity. Yeah, so everything will be encompassed in the past light cone of the observer at after R minus.
Yeah, so I mean, they're definitely two related things. But yeah, but I mean, you can just kind of imagine there's this, you're kind of receiving all this light in some finite time.
What do you mean exactly by starting from initial condition and moving forward from? What do you mean by that? Is this like solving an equation?
I mean, we'll talk about that. Sort of later in the class, how you can think of, I mean, so right now this is just the space-time, and we've sort of determined the space-time, and now we're just looking at geodesics on it, so it's not quite the same, but yeah, you can just say that any, if you now start to think of Einstein's equations as like an initial value formulation or something, where you start with some initial conditions, and then you evolve them forward in time, basically... You know, so if you specify some initial conditions here, at some later time, the value here is determined by basically these points here.
Okay.
But at this point here, it's, you know, you need some extra information, right? That's not specified by this.
So it's not deterministic at that point? Even though you've fixed your initial conditions, you can't say what is exactly happening after R.
Yeah. Basically, this like the, you know, the value here would not sort of be well posed with respect to these initial conditions. Yeah.
Why is that? Like, we know we have a singularity there, but it's like a coordinate singularity, right? So why it would have like a physical impact then?
Yeah. I mean, so it's basically saying like, if you were. If you were evolving and you were able to evolve sort of past that point, then you basically have some freedom what to do here. Like the equations wouldn't tell you exactly what would happen, right? Because it would depend on sort of what you specify here.
You know, I'm just like trying to compare this like with the other coordinate singularity that we know, for instance, in like spherical coordinate theta equal to like zero is the singularity, the coordinate singularity that we have. And it's not like very like important point, right? We can just like go to Cartesian coordinate and be like, oh, this is a very normal point.
Right.
And that's what I'm saying, like when I'm just thinking about that, having a Cauchy surface in like Cartesian space-time and like trying to like evolve the equation at all, theta equal to zero is not like important a point, so we should be able to like know, like predict it, and it should
So that's a example. So definitely, like you can have coordinates where the, you know, the space time is well defined at R minus. You can sort of extend the space time there. So I'm not saying there's a true singularity at R minus. I'm just saying that, you know, if you take a a point past R minus and then look at its past light cone, then it'll include points, you know, not specified here. So not all of its the points on its past light cone will intersect the surface.
You know, I can see it in the Penrose diagram, but you know, when I'm thinking about it physically, I cannot see why. Like, you know, yeah, in the Penrose diagram, we can see that there's like a discontinuity over there, and you know, we cannot like cover the whole Cauchy surface, but the physical point of view, again, it's like a coordinate singularity, so it should be a normal point in space-time.
Yeah, so there's nothing blowing up here. I mean, and you can specify a solution. You know, for example, this extended Kerr solution, but it's just that it has this property that this R minus is a Cauchy horizon, and so I mean, you basically have to put in this extra piece here. You couldn't have specified some initial data and then evolve towards there. You have to put in this extra stuff.
Probably because you know, our evolution is kind of like. Dependent on the fact that if you're looking at the space-like or time-like arrays, and you know that's the point that we are having this like discontinuity, and like the space-like vectors would be like time-like, so the evolution would be kind of messed up. I'm just trying to like see what's the physics, but okay. And also, another question: I don't fully remember why we care about like maximally extended. I remember like you know we have a patch for Kerr and just like adding up all together like as we do for Schwarzschild, right? But I don't know how it would be beneficial at least mathematically for us. Like what was the definition of maximally extending it and why we care about it? Like why people?
Maximally extended basically just means. Like sort of adding as much to the space-time as you can without, you know, as long as you still satisfy the Einstein equations. So basically, you know, if I just cut off the space-time here or something, then I could have, you know, geodesics that would sort of just end somewhere, but they kind of reach that point of finite time or something. For the reason I just said, we don't think that this maximum extended space-time has much to do with the physical situation where you take some matter and collapse it to form a black hole. And you know, what would happen if you were unlucky enough to jump into that black hole? This is basically kind of the sort of simple textbook picture then which you can use to then try to build on and understand. So it's sort of an ongoing field of research to determine, you know, what's the singularity inside a black hole in sort of the most generic setting. You know, is it space-like, is it time-like, or is it null, or some combination of those? Yeah.
I see. Just one more question. What was the definition of Cauchy surface again? It's just a normal surface, like a time-like surface?
This is a Cauchy horizon in the sense that, you know, past this point, if you sort of look at the you know, causal past of points here, that they don't intersect this surface.
So a surface that, you know, we cannot, like, fully determine it by the past, like, fully.
Yeah. Okay. So if there are no more questions. So the next thing I want to talk about is the ergosphere. So at the horizon, R equals R plus, we can take the norm of our killing vector associated with our stationary spacetime. So this is just in the Borel-Lindquist coordinates, it's just this. So we take the norm, and so this is just equal to GTT. And then using what's all the way at the top board, we get this quantity. And we can note that this is going to be positive, except you know, at theta equals 0 and theta equals pi. And so that means that this vector is actually space-like at the black hole horizon. You know, far away, it's just pointing the t direction, so it's time-like. But somewhere close to the black hole, it goes from being time-like to being space-like. So you know, we can ask if it makes this transition somewhere in between. It should be null, so we can check where that happens. So that's when this is equal to 0. Or equivalently when GTT is 0. Sorry, that's not right. That should be a sigma.
And delta minus a squared, right? Like GTT, it's delta minus a squared sine theta squared, right? You know, you said that GTT is 0, therefore delta is equal to.
Thank you. Yep. Yeah, though delta is 0 at the horizon, so that's why I dropped it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, at the horizon.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Sorry. That's the general expression, but at the horizon, this is 0. Yeah. So we can rewrite this, and we get. This expression here, so that basically defines the ergo region, or the ergo surface, the boundary between when this our Killing vector associated with stationarity goes from being time-like to being space-like. So just draw a picture. So here's the sort of head-on picture. So black hole spinning this way. The ergo surface meets it at the poles. And then at the equator, it extends to 2m. And then sort of the top-down view, black hole spinning this way. It's just in the equator, it's just the surface of r equals 2m.
Line that you specify for black hole is r minus, right?
Sorry, what's
the
again?
The line that you specify for the black hole, like the circle radius, is r minus, right?
This is r plus.
Ergosphere is not the region between r minus and r plus.
No.
It's not.
No.
So
it's outside the black hole. So, yeah. That would be R between R plus and I minus, that's in the black hole interior. But this is outside the black hole, it's outside R plus. It's basically between you know, this region and R plus. So it's outside the black hole. Somewhere this vector becomes space-like. And so in a little bit we'll talk about how this region actually corresponds to the region where you can tap into the black hole's rotational energy. The black hole can do work. That's where the term ergosphere comes from. But first, I just want to mention how the ergo region is also the region where observers have to sort of essentially rotate with the black hole. So to see that, we can write down the normalization condition for the forward velocity of some time-like observer. So if we just expand this out using our Bori-Lindquist coordinates, we get the following. So all these terms on the top line, you know, have to be greater than or equal to zero, right? They're just if we just look at the metric coefficients, so these are always positive, and we just said the GTT inside the ergo region also becomes positive. So all these quantities are positive. And so that means, you know, to add up to minus one, we need this quantity to be negative. And, you know, we can note that GT phi is less than zero, and UT is just by definition is just how fast coordinate time.
Sorry, is it less than zero or less than or equal to minus one? I mean, could it be like minus half, or is it less or equal to minus one?
I mean, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then, so since this is negative and this is positive, therefore we need this one to be positive as well. So this basically tells you that you're not allowed to have a time like observer that sort of sits at constant phi in the ergo region, because then that its forward velocity doesn't actually correspond to a forward velocity of a time like observer. Yes.
GTT is a negative quantity, right? So.
We just argued here that it's negative
inside of
outside the ergo region, but inside the ergo region, we basically defined it as when it becomes positive. Yeah. Yeah, so since we're not allowed to have zero phi velocity, we can knock.
What did you start with? You started with GT phi being less than zero and UT being bigger than zero, therefore U phi is bigger than zero?
So I basically just say we're in the ergo region and we want to satisfy this condition.
And then
we need this one to be, this combination to be negative, and then this one is negative, this one is positive. And so then we need this one to be positive as well. Yep, and so now we can consider some observer that's sitting instantaneously at constant radius, but has some phi velocity. So let's call that chi. It's going to be this combination of the time-like Killing vector and some component in the phi direction. Instead of choosing this to be zero, since that's not allowed, we can instead consider what are called zero angular momentum observers or ZAMOs. So those would be the one where basically the angular momentum measured with respect to this axisymmetric Killing vector is zero. So if I just work out what that condition gives, it's that G phi phi or G phi t plus G phi phi times omega equals zero. Or said another way, it's omega
why are we assuming this to be zero?
I'm basically just working out what the angular velocity of a ZAMO is a zero angular momentum observer, and this is just the definition of that. So we have this conserved quantity, the angular momentum, and this is zero when this quantity is zero. And so we want to see what the zero angular momentum observer, what its angular velocity will be.
Why is that angular momentum? Phi times chi?
So I mean, this is going to be the basic, we'll talk a little bit more about this soon when we talk about geodesics, but this is basically the conserved quantity associated with this axisymmetric Killing vector is the angular momentum up to some normalization.
Okay, like the reason that I had in my mind was like this chi is like the timeline of the observer, so it's like u alpha for the observer. That's why like phi times u alpha basically says it's like p phi, so p phi is the angular momentum, right? Like since you know time like observer, at least locally when they're looking at themselves, it's not just like just t, like 1, 0, 0, 0, like energy 0, 0, 0. It's like energy and angular momentum. And then when I multiply it by phi, like u phi, dotting them together will give me p phi, which is lz, right?
Sorry, I didn't quite follow that, but...
Like, yeah. Are we looking at chi as the observer's like velocity? Like the particle's velocity, like timeline?
Yeah, so this is going to be up to some normalization.
Yeah.
This omega is basically going to be d phi dt.
Exactly, phi dot.
Or d phi d tau. But then to get the angular momentum, it's basically you have to look at the quantity with the downstairs indices, right, by contracting these axisymmetric Killing vector. So that's what I'm doing here. And that's why you pick up these two components. So if we look at what this combination of the metric quantities gives as we approach the black hole horizon, we get that omega is actually going to be a bar over 2r plus. So a lot of times that's referred to as the horizon frequency of the black hole. So as this zero angular momentum observer approaches the horizon, it has to go at this angular velocity. So we call that the angular velocity of the horizon. And yeah, so just one further note. So if I define chi A to be the following. So now here, instead of letting omega be arbitrary, I'm fixing it to be the horizon velocity of the black hole. So you can see that this is a linear combination of two Killing vectors, right? And so therefore, it's also a Killing vector. But this Killing vector is going to become null on the horizon. But it's time-like. Approaching r plus, and so therefore it basically, the terminology people use is it generates the black hole's event horizon, and that's as its Killing horizon. So we'll come back to that vector several times. And just briefly, I want to take a look at what the value of omega h does for different values of spin. So for a very small spin, r plus is close to 2 with this correction, close to 2m. And so omega h is given by approximately that quantity, mentioned the spin over 4m. And then we can consider approaching this extremal limit of maximum spin to still have a horizon. So, and that limit R plus is going towards M.
It's just
and approaching this extremal limit, it's just a little bit larger than M, and this horizon frequency is approaching just 1 over 2m. Okay, so any questions about that?
Just coming to this last part, as you were talking about setting R equal to R plus and calling that angular momentum of the horizon, can you quite get that part? Can you move your motion time, please?
I just said that basically if you take, so we calculated the angular velocity of these ZAMOs, we got this quantity here, and then basically if we evaluate that quantity as R goes to R plus, we get this quantity they call the mega H. And so that's basically the angular velocity that zero angular momentum observer has to have as it crosses the event horizon. And so you can associate that with sort of the angular velocity of the horizon itself. Okay, so now I want to start talking about geodesics on Kerr. So geodesics are defined as these basically trajectories that are very small test bodies that don't affect the space-time it follow. And they can also be used to give some intuition for what will happen in the sort of the back reacting case. And in fact, I'll mention a little bit about at the end how though you don't expect these geodesic equations to apply, for example, to a binary black hole or something like that, they can already give you some intuition about what might happen there. So just as a reminder, the geodesic equation is given by the following in terms of the four velocity along the geodesic. Where we're going to concentrate on time-like geodesics, where we can parameterize them by their proper time, which I'll call tau. And so then this four velocity is just the derivative of the position along the geodesic with respect to proper time. And then our geodesics will satisfy this normalization condition, basically the definition of proper time. If we had null geodesics, then this would be equal to zero, and we'd have to use some different affine parameter instead of proper time. Generically, if we write this out, we have second order equations. That we'd want to integrate on our space-time, but we can sort of get away with not doing that by using the fact that we have conserved quantities along our geodesics. Yesterday we mentioned how Kerr has these two killing vectors, how these killing vectors have the satisfy this killing equation. So that means that if we take some, that basically means that these sort of immediately gives you the fact that along these geodesics. The quantity where you contract your forward velocity with these killing vectors is conserved. So we can work out what our two conserved quantities are with respect to the killing vector associated with our stationarity and with axis symmetry. So the first constant we have is the energy. So I introduced a minus sign, so it would correspond to, well, so roughly this would be the energy divided by the rest mass of this test particle, just by the tilde there. And then we also have one associated with the axisymmetry. We just mentioned before, talking about Zamos. So that's forward velocity at the lower index. And if we raise that in our Borel-Lindquist coordinates, it's this combination of the two quantities with upper indices. Yes.
And how can we generalize this for like killing tensors?
Yeah. So, So, as you mentioned last time, there's this concept of a killing tensor. We have some, symmetric tensor that satisfies that condition. So just the generalization, and then basically you can get the same condition here, where if you construct some constant by contracting your two forward velocities with this killing tensor, then by basically the same argument, you can derive that this constant will be conserved along the geodesics. And as someone pointed out last class, the sort of a trivial solution to this is just to use the metric for k, right? Because of metric compatibility, this will satisfy this equation. And indeed, we can, realize that this quantity is conserved. In fact, it's just equal to minus one, so it doesn't give us anything new. But it indeed satisfies that. Yeah. And so yesterday I mentioned this Carter constant, which one can construct from this killing tensor associated with Kerr. Basically, that constant. That quantity being constant, if you consider a particle that sort of has zero velocity, or that only has a phi velocity and r velocity and is in the equatorial plane, the conservation of that Carter constant basically says that it'll stay in the equatorial plane. For orbits that go outside, they're non-equatorial, it's more complicated, but today we're just going to talk about equatorial orbits. So this just basically says we can stick to the equator. All right. Yeah, so just wanted to write out this equation for the angular momentum, J tilde, in terms of our coordinates. That's Thank you. given by that.
Plus a squared squared, right?
Is that true?
Because G55 has it.
Yep, yes, you're right. Thank you. Okay, so, yeah, so as I just mentioned, from now on, we're gonna restrict to equatorial orbits. So we're going to assume that the theta component of the velocity is zero, and that we're in the equator. Okay, so now let's take this normalization condition that I wrote down there and write it out now in terms of these conserved quantities. And so here, you are with a lower indices. We can get just by using the metric to lower you are with upper indices, upper index. And you can recall from there that delta is just given by this. And here I start writing things in terms of the upper indices, so we can get those from the metric that I wrote there just using the usual matrix inversion. Again, with this restriction, they become simpler, so they're given by the following. All right, make sure to get the square this time. And GRR is this. And G55 upper indices is that. And last one, GTG5. All right. Yeah, so this equation is going to be important, so we'll call it star. So just plugging that in, we can rewrite star as the following. All right. So then, gonna basically move this term to the right-hand side, and then multiply by r squared and collect some powers. And then once the dust clears there, we're gonna end up with the following. And then we'll call this whole thing our potential, which depends on E, J, and R. So we can note that you know, this quantity, will, without the minus sign, it should be greater than or equal to zero. So, but with this minus sign, basically, you know, to have allowed geodesics, we need to be in some part of the, you know, have some choice of these quantities such that these are less than or equal to zero. And we can also notice, so here we have this polynomial in R that starts with a quartic, though there's no constant term, so we can just factor out one power of R from all these, and we just have a cubic times R. And you can also note that when this quantity here is equal to zero, so the zeros of this polynomial, that corresponds to where u r should also be zero, right? So these will basically be the turning points of the orbit. So the, you know, radius can increase or decrease until it hits one of these zeros, and then it will turn around again. So first I want to talk about bound orbits. So those are ones with this quantity E tilde, where it's less than one. So you can see that, you know, basically if you have some quantity that, you know, has some non-zero velocity at infinity, that would correspond to this E tilde being greater than one. And then so the marginal case would be where E tilde equals one, where you'd go out to, you know, basically just if you have zero velocity at infinity, then yeah, that would be E tilde equals one.
How can I can't see when E is equal to 1 at infinity, U is 0. If I plug E equal to 1 in that equation there, U R is 0?
Well, yeah, so this quantity is going to go like R to the fourth to this, the delta squared. But maybe it's easier to see if we just look at, you know, this quantity.
Oh, right.
So just, you know, just at infinity, basically, we just have this is minus one, right? If you have no other components, yeah. Yeah, so if we're in this bound case, then this, you know, this quantity blows up like r to the fourth at large r. So we're not. So basically, that means that you can't go to infinitely large r if you're bound. There's some, you reach some turning point before then. We can also evaluate v at the horizon at r plus. So we can actually factor that into the following. And see that that's always going to be negative. And so, yeah, last thing before we in class. So you can basically deduce that, as I mentioned, V over R is just going to be a cubic. And we know that, so therefore it's either going to have one or three zeros. And, restricting to this bound case, we said that V is going to blow up for large R, and it's going to be negative by the time we reach the horizon. So basically, just sketching, we have two different possibilities. One is that we have something like, in this case, with these three zeros, and let's call this R plus here. Or we have a case like this with just one zero. And so, if you're in this case, you would, again, you have to be in the positive, the place where this V is negative. So could start here, but you would just fall towards the black hole. Or if you had some velocity here, you'd go, till you hit this turning point and then come back down. So to have orbits that that don't immediately fall into the black hole, those would correspond to ones like here, where you could go back and forth within this range. So maybe it's a good place to end here, but then next class we'll talk about sort of the marginal case where this only touches at a point, and those would correspond to the circular orbits, the ones where you would sit at constant radius. So let me stop and ask if there are any questions.
What was this diagrams again? This is V and R?
You can think of it as a sketch of V over R, or just if you multiply it by R, it's just going to be similar. But then once you go to R equals 0, it should also go to back up to 0.
Sorry, I didn't get that. So that is V over R?
Yeah.
V over R, and then the horizontal line is R, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so this, we know it needs to be, blowing up like R cubed in this case. Large R, and that it should be negative for R plus.
Because, but in my mind, I'm just like thinking about the effective potential, and I was thinking, oh, we have a particle coming from here, and it would just like bounce off. But I was like, oh, it's going to infinity. How is that possible? But if you just multiply it by minus sign, you will get that idea of the V effective that we use.
Yeah. So if you have unbound particles, then basically this would switch, and so then this would go down there, and you have ones that could come in from infinity.
And then the orbits would be
Yeah, and then they either...
That point that you were saying, the circular orbit, that's an unstable circular orbit, right?
This one would be stable. So the unstable one would be a case like this would be the unstable one, right? Because if you...
That happens when your circular orbit is equal to R plus.
No, yes. So we're getting to what we're going to talk about next class, but I mean, yeah, basically, so if you're in this situation, right, if you're at this point, and I'm saying this is outside R plus because it should already be negative at R plus. Yeah, this would correspond to an unstable circular orbit, right? Because you could, if you perturb it a little bit here, then it would want to fall into the black hole. Or if you perturb it a little bit the other way, then it would want to oscillate back and forth here, right?
Look at like that, how can
then,
the particle even get there?
Hmm?
If you look at like this, how can the particle even get there? Like my particle coming from R equals to infinity, and it sees like a barrier, which is the effective potential that goes to infinity, and it just like bounce off, right?
Yeah, so this would not correspond to a geodesic that came in from infinity. So like, you know, this one right here would correspond to a circular geodesic. So it's just going around in a circle.
How can the particle get there? So it will go to.
Yeah, I mean, there are various ways, but one way is to come in from infinity and lose some energy. Exchanging energy with something else. So in binary black holes, for example, we think that, basically they're sort of go through a sequence of what are called quasi-circular orbits. The radius of those circular orbits is decreasing, basically, because the system is losing energy and angular momentum to gravitational waves. But these circular orbits do not correspond to ones that came in from infinity. They correspond to ones that are just going around in a circle.
I see.
Any other questions? All right. See you all next week.